This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Andy Robbins talks with actor Scott Turner Schofield. He will discuss gender identity on Wednesday at this year's Respecting Differences program in Kalamazoo. But first, a new report finds that 38% of households in Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties are either in poverty or near the poverty line. The United Way released the numbers last week for this region and the state of Michigan. Matt Lynn is Director of Community Impact for the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo region. Matt Lynn, thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here. Good morning to you, Gordon.
So this report includes an acronym called ALICE, A-L-I-C-E. Let's get to the E in a moment, but first of all, talk about those first four letters, asset limited and income constrained. What does that mean for the layperson?
Well, it's a classification of folks that find themselves living above what we consider the traditional poverty line, may find themselves employed, but certainly don't have the financial means as far as income to be able to afford basic necessities, plus have additional revenue to afford possibly creating a savings account, putting money away for their children's college education, being able to even go out, even maybe once a month to a movie with their family. So when we talk about asset limited, it's those that may not own their own home or own their own car. When we talk about income constrained, it's those that have an income, but it just isn't enough to be able to get them to that place where they can afford all the amenities and have that quality of life that they want and may still need some type of assistance in order to be able to make ends meet.
And the E stands for employed. So we're talking about people who are working.
Absolutely. We're talking about people who are working or possibly people that are living on a fixed income as a pension or retirement.
There has been a drop in the unemployment rate and more jobs created both in Michigan and nationwide.
Right.
Has that gone any way toward addressing the problem or closing the gap that we're talking about?
Well, it's always a good thing when your job market is actually growing. That means you have more people that are going to work, which means we have more people ultimately that aren't below the level and in that poverty queue that have moved into that ALICE space, if you want to call it that. But what we know is that out of the all the jobs that have been created since the recession has died down, 62% of those still pay below $20 an hour, and two-thirds of those pay below $15 an hour. So even while more people are entering the job market, they're still entering at a level where they're just maybe above the crest of where they can qualify for public assistance programs that are federally funded. And that's where you have organizations like United Way to support organizations and programs that can meet the needs of those individuals who are working but yet and still need that additional financial resource in order to afford their basic necessities.
How do these numbers track with things like race and ethnicity? Are we more likely to see African Americans living in poverty or close to it than, say, white families?
That's a very good question. And the immediate answer is yes, because we do have within the report, and we do know by other data resources that we have a gender gap and we have a race gap when it comes to wage and earned income. When we talk about the unemployment rates as an example, where we see the overall statistics may lay for the state of Michigan or even for our county, we know that in African-American communities, it's usually about two times greater than the overall rate for unemployment. In our Hispanic and Latino population, it's usually about 1.5 to 2 times greater as well. So that at least indicates that there are some factors that do exist around the race gap when we talk about income earnings over a lifetime. With gender, we see that same thing where women tend to earn less than maybe their male counterparts for doing the same type of work or having the same type of job. Those are some policy issues that certainly we hope that will be addressed. And we see legislation starting to move in that direction where those are focal points. But yet and still, it is a major factor when we talk about the economic viability of households within our region and within our state.
Well, you mentioned gender, and that kind of transitions into something that I wanted to talk about as well, which is age, because women on average are likely to live longer than men.
Right.
So if they are living longer, making less money, are we also seeing that people who are elderly, retired, no longer in the workforce, are part of this group which is struggling?
We do. We actually recognize that we also have more folks who would retire at potentially age 65 working longer because their pension or the Social Security income that they would draw just isn't there necessarily to provide enough income for them to live comfortably in retirement. So as a result, they're working longer. They're having to find different means to supplement what they are receiving from pension in order to be able to live a comfortable life and not slide below all those poverty factors we find within the community.
Does a struggling household mean something for their neighbor who may not be struggling? They may not fall into this Alice category, but if there's a lot of people, 38% in Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties, does that mean something for the people who are living somewhat more comfortably? Does it have effects for them?
Well, hopefully it means that they're recognizing the living conditions for their neighbors and having a better understanding of what are we really talking about when we say that people are financially struggling and who are they? I think we'd like to sometimes believe that people have the ability to pick themselves up by their bootstraps, as you call it. And recently I was reading an article where an author had talked about the fact that the bootstraps mentality is a mystery. It really doesn't exist, that we've all benefited from hands out and hands up to support us getting where we want to go. When we talk about Alice, the interesting thing, Gordon, is that these are folks we see every day in our community. They're the people we encounter. They're the ones that take care of our children. They're the ones that fix our cars. They're the ones that are providing health care for us or for our aging parents in our hospitals, our nurses. So we're around Alice individuals every single day. And we may not know that. When the first report came out in 2014, we spent the last couple of years getting the acronym and the understanding of who Alice is out in the community. And it's taken a foothold. You know, I'm in more meetings where people talk about Alice without United Way prompting it, so they know what that means. Now the next step is, how do we take action around addressing the issues that really affect our Alice households and those in poverty every day? When you use the 38%, we're really talking about combined, those that find themselves below that poverty line, as well as those that are working every day but are financially struggling.
So people who might be just above the poverty line, they're worried about slipping into poverty.
That's correct. That's one of the wonderful things about this report, is it helps to recognize that people are one crisis away. Your car breaks down and all of a sudden the small amount of savings that you've had is gone. And now all of a sudden I'm thrust into making a decision on, do I buy medicine for my child? Do I pay my rent? Do I pay my utility bill? Because now my cash that I had on hand, that was my nest egg, my reserve, is gone. And I don't know what I'm going to do now.
And you mentioned actually in the report preparing for a natural disaster.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to, of course, have broad implications for a lot of people. But if you're someone who is a little better off, you probably have insurance and you probably have the means to, you know, get through a couple weeks before you get a check from the insurance company. Someone struggling probably doesn't, right?
That's correct. You may not have a job that's allowed you to have maybe a 403B or a 401K that you can tap into during that small amount of time when I maybe need to do some repairs around my home, or the insurance, as you mentioned as well. That's also a big factor that we always don't consider, but certainly is a lingering issue and comes to the head during crisis time. So think about the flood that's going on now, you know, and households that are affected by that. If you don't have flood insurance, all of a sudden you find yourself having to pay for damages that, you know, you may not have accounted for in the small amount of income that you have. What do? Where do you turn? How do you find a means to get out of that hole now that you find yourself in it? And it's not your fault.
As you mentioned, you know, you've taken this step of trying to get this as part of the conversation, the idea of Alice and what it means to be in poverty or close to poverty. And now the next step is addressing it. So from strictly the United Way standpoint, what do you do next to try and help people who are either in poverty or maybe thinking that they will be in poverty soon?
That's a great question. A couple of years ago, when we started to evolve our strategic mapping for our organization, an intentional focus was to build our goals, our mission, our vision, to surround Alice and have a better recognition that in all the things that we do as an organization, Alice has to be one of those key platform pieces. So when we look at our targeted goals around education in high school, graduation rates, as well as decreasing some of those disparity rates, it is targeting those youth that are coming from those ALICE households that may not necessarily have the means or the resources from the earliest stages of their educational experience in order to be able to gain advantage and get ahead. So how do we make sure that schools that are connected with ALICE populations have the available resources they need to properly educate our children and move them towards that education and that graduation that leads to a really better job for them?
Of course, that's a longer term solution because there's people now who are looking for jobs or maybe in jobs that, pay something, but you know, as you say, leave them in a situation where they're not very secure financially.
Absolutely. And we have an ambitious goal within our what we call our income area, where we look at housing and we look at workforce supports. And that is to, over the next 10 years, move 8,500 households in our region above that economic line and to move away from being in poverty and now more towards economic stability. That's ambitious. It takes a collective effort, and it takes surrounding now multiple organizations all working together towards that common goal. So when we talk about housing in the immediate, how do we prevent individuals from becoming homeless due to eviction or a foreclosure, and looking at organizations that help support those populations, maybe with the financial resources immediately to eliminate that immediate crisis and then continue to move on with them with coaching, with case management, so they don't get back into that crisis. As individuals are moving into employment, how do we make sure we've got available supports, childcare, transportation, those key things that would otherwise maybe prevent them from staying employed? So it's not just about attainment, it's also the retainment of employment.
So that means working with some other nonprofit groups in the area. Are there also some things that you would like policymakers to look at and perhaps address that they might see in this report?
Absolutely. We certainly hope that our legislators will come to understand really who is ALICE as part of their constituency within the communities that they represent in Lansing and even in Washington, and carrying their voice, carrying their concerns as well, and understanding how policies and processes either are affecting families by keeping them below that line and not allowing them to move up. So when you talk about issues of inequity, as an example, there's certainly policies that may go way back in history that affect individuals to be able to move above that line. And legislators have the tools and they have the resources to be able to adjust some of those policies. So helping them better understand that is important.
Matt Lynn, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Gordon. Glad to be here.
Matt Lynn is Director of Community Impact for the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo region. Links to the United Way's report on ALICE data and low-income households in Southwest Michigan can be found at WMUK.org.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Andy Robbins. The issue at this year's Respecting Differences event in Kalamazoo is gender inclusion. The sessions Wednesday are sponsored by Western Michigan University and several other schools and local governments. Transgender actor and activist Scott Turner Schofield will talk about what he sees as a society in transition when it comes to accepting how people express gender. Schofield says his interest in the issue started early.
It all started a long time ago when I was in high school in Charlotte, North Carolina, where defeated Governor Pat McCrory was then, at the time, mayor. And there was a real big debacle over actually a theater show called Angels in America, which came to Charlotte. And there was a terribly homophobic incident that actually took a national stage where the homophobic politicians in the area decided to defund everything. They defunded children's arts programs. They defunded the symphony because they did not want arts funding supporting what they called the homosexual agenda at the time. Now, at the time, I was a 15-year-old person who I didn't really know what my labels were. I didn't know anything except that I was different and that everything they were saying felt like an attack on me. And what ended up happening in Charlotte, North Carolina, is that the community really rallied and they created their own private arts funding organization that ended up funding way more than the government ever did. And it was a real slap in the face of homophobic politicians. All of them were deposed. They went down in infamy, which was really amazing. You know, it was theater, it was LGBT politics and rights. It was, understanding my place as an individual in a homophobic society. At the time, I didn't even know I was trans yet, because that word wouldn't even come to me until I was 20 years old. That label wouldn't even start to make sense in my development as a person, which is often the case for a lot of transgender people. But it was a really kind of galvanizing moment to understand my power as an individual to work collectively with other people, and it just so happened to be around the arts. I was a theater student, and so I really understood the power of theater and using your voice in an artistic way, and then I saw how it worked in a community activism kind of way, and I've been doing it literally ever since.
Now, you have combined, as you say, your concern and activism in these issues with your career. I believe you were the first openly trans character on a daytime drama.
Openly trans actor, yeah, in daytime. Playing a trans character also, but yes.
What was that experience like?
It was amazing. It's so funny because nobody I know watches The Bold and the Beautiful, but it's actually the most watched television show on the planet. It has 33 million viewers per day. And the international press, as well as, it happened kind of during the transgender tipping point moment when Caitlyn Jenner came out and, Orange is the New Black was huge and all those things. And so it was this really big moment to step onto a global platform and kind of shine my light as a person who has come through a lot of adversity, who has really made it my mission to help others get through easier than I did. It was really, really amazing. And I'm still feeling the effects of that.
Now, you also have a one-man show. 127 Ways to Become a Man, I believe is the title.
Becoming a Man in 127 Easy Steps.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Becoming a Man in 127 Easy Steps is a one-man show about my experience of being a man. And, a lot of the work that you see about transgender people really focuses on our transition, that very dramatic moment in our lives when we decide to make our true selves known to the world. And that shows up as part of my story, but it also shows up as, what it was like being 4 years old and finally getting what gender was in a very traumatic way, traumatic to me at the time. I thought I was going to play Mickey Mouse in a school play. And the whole time during all of the rehearsals and everything, I was sure that I was playing Mickey. And then on the day of the recital, my mom showed up with a Minnie Mouse costume. And I just like lost it, and it was this really sort of intense moment for me. And then, all the way up through what it's like to be, to be me now. For instance, I'm getting married, and my whole process of asking my girlfriend to marry me was beset with all of these messages that I'd been getting my entire life about how I'm unworthy to marry another person, either because, for a while I thought I was a lesbian, or because of what, transgender rights are now, that this act of deciding that I love this person and I want to be with them for the rest of my life and I want to give all that I am and all that I have to them, was clouded by all of these political messages that had been just pushed on me since childhood, right? So the process of working through that to the moment where I ask her to marry me, right, is one of the stories. So it's kind of the story of a whole life instead of just one part, which is our transition, which is very important, very dramatic, very interesting. But I think it's time to tell more of a story around that.
You've said that we're a society in transition when it comes to attitudes towards gender, transgender people, and non-binary people is a term that we're hearing more about. How do you think that transition is going?
You know, transition is always mixed, right? There's that amazing inspiration of, I've got to move forward. We've got to change. And that's so great. And then there's all that fear and hesitation and all that stuff that holds us back, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be transition, right? It would just be moving forward, right? And there are many fearful people who don't like change. And I know a bit about not liking change myself. I mean, I laugh all the time. I say I'm a transgender person who doesn't love change, right? Like, change can be difficult. And, unfortunately, a lot of times we think of that phrase, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. So we can get caught up in like, oh, well, maybe we should stay with the way things are because, better the devil you know, right? Even though it doesn't work for everybody, even though people are being excluded, even though 41% of people are attempting suicide because of the way that we do gender, we should maybe stay with that, rather than saying, no, there's a better way. All we have to do is open ourselves up, embrace new things, be positive and be creative. Right. So, I think you're seeing all of those things in our society's transition. And, that's to be, I really understand it. And I really make room for people who are scared and who don't understand. And that's why I do the work that I do, because I want people to understand that this is not a big deal, but that we do have to find a better way, because we cannot have this many kids attempting suicide as we do.
You've said that you like to try to approach these issues by making everyone as comfortable as they can be, but there has to be, some discomfort on all sides, at least occasionally.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is to just really hold space for that and to say, look, I get it, and it's okay for you to have that. It's not okay for you to be mean about it, right? You know how sometimes we get scared and we get mean? We get defensive and angry, right? Like, that's a totally natural thing to do. But if we're going to do this, we have to do it really consciously and be brave enough to say, I'm really scared about this. I really don't understand this. And it's really a block for me. And then to be brave enough to listen rather than ignoring people out of hand. The most frustrating thing that I deal with as a transgender person is people who, when I say, look, here's a really easy way to make things easier for transgender people. Say, for instance, when you're doing new construction anywhere that's public, making gender-neutral bathrooms, right? Gender-neutral bathrooms are wonderful because it means that if I'm a dad and I have a young daughter and she needs to go to the restroom, I don't have to worry. If I'm a mom and I'm taking my elderly father who needs help going to the restroom, I can take him. That's okay. If I'm a disabled person, I have the room to move, right? Like, gender-neutral bathrooms are for everybody. But people just dismiss it out of hand as though the transgender part of that experience that's ridiculous. It can't be like that. I mean, you wouldn't believe how many times I hear people talk like that. Rather than agreeing to consciously listen and take in all of the facts and really consider what it would mean to make a small change in the world, right? I think Republicans and Democrats, if we listen to each other that way about entitlement reform or infrastructure, right? Like, we could actually really, if we just listened rather than getting all defensive and wanting to keep things the same, not change, I think we would have a much easier time with it. And, part of that is saying, look, I get that you're scared. I get that this is hard, and that's okay. But now we have to all take a deep breath and listen to one another and figure it out.
The trend in the so-called bathroom bill arena seems to be heading away from restrictions that prevent trans people from using the bathroom that they prefer to use. I would assume you consider that a victory.
Absolutely. The bathroom bills are still, there are still many of them on the books. They're still working their way through different state legislatures. And luckily, people are really getting mostly through financial pressure. I mean, in Texas, the bill is being considered already killed, even though it's still going up for a vote, just because of the oil companies are threatening to leave Texas. I mean, can you imagine Texas without the oil companies? No, right? So So, you know, these organizations where they do value diversity and the things that every diverse person has to offer, right, are saying, if you're not going to value our diversity, then we're going to take it someplace else. You know, I consider that consciousness to be a major win. Right. I wish that people had the consciousness of understanding that transgender people have been using these bathrooms like forever. There are no instances where, you know, these fears that are coming up about predators using the bathrooms, like, that isn't happening. Those are fears that were constructed, right? I wish people would get on board with that. But if it takes just big companies having economic pressure to kill these bills, well, I'll take what I can get.
I wanted to touch on the non-binary issue, people who prefer not to be known as either a male or female, and that gets to what you might call the pronoun issue. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So non-binary is one term that's kind of an umbrella term to refer to a whole bunch. There are, if you even go on Facebook right now and you say, I want to change what my gender descriptor is, there are 50 different words that you could pick, right? So whatever your comfort is, whatever feels like it most resonates with you, I think that's really awesome because, you know, it doesn't matter what you call yourself in the end, but you do have to feel comfortable, right? So non-binary folks are folks who are like, look, I don't like these definitions of a man or a woman that society has given us. And I prefer to just be me. And I deserve to be respected for just being me, just the same way that I want to respect other people for just being them, however you show up in the world, whatever your gender expression may be, right? And so that can look really different. You know, if you imagine David Bowie in the 80s, right, or Annie Lennox in the 80s, then, right, like a very kind of like, what am I looking at kind of experience, right? And a lot of folks ask not to be referred to by male or female pronouns, right? Not as he or she, but rather as any number of things. But again, kind of an umbrella term we use is they as the singular. I get that that's new for a lot of people. I get most people have probably never referred to one person as they in their lives, and it grates them to think about doing so. But all of the dictionaries have agreed that this is okay. You can go look it up. They was the word of the year in 2015. And using they as a singular pronoun when you're trying to respect somebody else's gender identity is completely grammatically okay by every style guide there is.
When you speak in Kalamazoo during the Respecting Differences event on April 12th, what do you hope that, if there's one top line thing you hope people take away from that event, what would it be?
Well, what I'm hoping to offer folks, it's really for people who are trans and non-binary who want to come and feel like hear somebody speaking their language, hear somebody saying out loud the things that we know are true. So I really want that, and I especially want that for young people. It's a totally family-friendly event. Young people who really need to hear somebody who's gone through it and who's speaking from a platform, really honoring them. Like, that's a big thing that I want. But also what I want is folks who are really struggling with this, people who, you know, just don't get it, right? What I want to offer for folks like that is a really safe space to come to listen and hear ideas without feeling attacked. I'm not going to attack you. I'm going to offer you some ideas with utter respect for where you're coming from, with what I think is a mutual desire to make the world better and safer and more comfortable for a group of people in our culture who, let's just say, are having a really hard time of it. You know, those are the values that I'm coming to this with. And you're going to learn words and concepts that I hope will make it easier for you to go out and do that in your own daily life in whatever ways you want to or are able to.
Actor Scott Turner Schofield is the keynote speaker at the Respecting Differences event in Kalamazoo this Wednesday. The session's at 9:30 in the morning and 1:30 that afternoon at Miller Auditorium are free and open to the public. You've been listening to WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Andy Robbins. Please join us again at this time Thursday, and thanks for listening.